If you attended any of the women's marches the day after inauguration, or so much as peeked at Facebook the day after that, you saw more than a few signs with slogans like "Love Trump's hate, resistance is fertile," and a favorite of our producer, "Protesting is the new brunch." It all feels very 2017, but signs and posters are pretty old school. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're starting today's show with the history of political posters. It dates back to World War I. Later on, we'll bring this conversation into the present as we look at online forums for drumming up support, maybe even spreading propaganda. So let's get going. Doran Cart is with us from the National World War I Museum here in Kansas City. Hi, Doran.
Good morning, Gina.
The current exhibit you've got on display is called Posters as Munitions, and the title's based on a quote from a historian?
That's correct. Martin Hardy, in 1920, wrote a history of the posters from the war, and he said it was obvious from the very beginning that posters were a main munition of the war, because they would contribute to the war effort of the nations as well as anything else that was considered a munition.
So what, if you had to say that there's like a main idea that you're really hoping to convey with this exhibit, what is it?
Well, I think it's basically following another quote by Martin Hardy, and said that poster's job was to waylay the person and to impress their meaning upon them. And that's basically kind of what I'm following in the exhibition.
You know, if we're talking about World War I, I mean, war is declared now and then, not by the public or their opinions, but by politicians. And at that time, not, you know, a lot of these politicians were not democratically elected. And so I'm curious about why impressing an opinion or a meaning upon the average viewer of a poster, how did that contribute to war?
Well, because regardless of who declared war or who gave the proclamation to declare war, they couldn't do it by themselves. They had to have both the military power and the makeup of the military forces, as well as mobilizing the society. Because at that time, basically the whole society of all the nations that were involved in the war had to be mobilized, both to create the materials from the war, to provide the persons who would be in the war, and also to support it, because it couldn't be done just by the, as I call them, the silk hats. It had to be done by the people who actually would do the work, both in the war effort and in carrying out the war itself.
You can't have begrudging warriors?
No.
Okay. That phrase, "the pen is mightier than the sword," kind of comes to mind here. Just in a way, I feel like the idea you're expressing is that words on paper aren't necessarily any less violent than a sword. I mean, that the pen could actually be a sword.
That's correct. And also, you have to remember that in many of the countries that used posters during the war, a lot of people were illiterate or didn't necessarily speak the language of that country that they were in. And so the graphic nature of the posters helped to convey some of the message even without words. Some of them have very few words.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, there's actually one poster. It's not in the exhibition because all of our posters in the exhibition are from 1917. But there's one from Australia, and it's the globe covered with blood, and there's this German gorilla that's grabbing the globe. There are no words at all. And so that
how do you know this is a German?
Well, it's of course the typical signature that they put on everything was the spiked helmet, which was the kind of the sign of a German soldier at the beginning of World War I.
So this brings up the question of whether posters functioned in the same way from country to country, or if they influenced public opinion in a very specific way, just across the board.
Well, they all followed a very similar path, because almost every country, every belligerent that used posters, used them for a specific purpose. So they wanted you to enlist, or they wanted you to give money for the war effort, or they wanted you to save food, or they wanted you to act in a particular way. They wanted you to talk in a particular way or not talk in a particular way. They wanted you to prove your patriotism by supporting the war effort.
Can you tell us about one that's encouraging people to talk or not talk in a particular way? That's creepy.
Well, it is. And because when you really to give you an example, in the United States, when the United States entered the war in April of 1917, there was an Office of Public Information that was created, and everything that was given to the public at that time, including posters, was censored. It was created to impress the values that the administration at that time wanted to be heard.
So let's back up a little bit so that we all kind of understand the history that we're dealing with now that we understand why we're talking about posters. I mean, talk to me about posters before World War I.
Okay, posters really came from the chromolithography process that had actually started in the 18th century. And it developed over the years from there. And then when they got to where they can mass produce posters, and they were used for advertising primarily. And so, you know, for bicycles or whatever they were advertising. And then
seems innocent enough.
Well, it was, because it was basically for merchandising. And so when World War I came along, they quickly realized that these were tools that could be used to impress other values and other ideas on the populace who was viewing them.
Like, if we can convince you to buy a bicycle, we can convince you to believe a certain thing?
That's correct. Or we can convince you to buy a war bond if you're patriotic enough, or that you'll quit eating meat on the days we want you to.
But what changed? Can you identify a specific turning point, or was it more gradual? I mean, we're talking about they, and the nefarious they is always kind of like, who are they?
Well, it happened very quickly, and the people who started using them as early as 1914 very quickly went from an advertising medium to a country's medium to use to impress their values and their ideas on their populace.
Is there like a first one that we know about?
Well, probably the earliest ones were done by the British, and they were fairly plain. They weren't very artistic. They didn't have a lot of imagery on them, but they were just rules, kind of what to save your clothes and to not, abuse animals, things like that. It was very
Where were these posters with rules? I mean, where did they put them?
Well, they would plaster them up everywhere, on sides of buildings, in structures, on walls.
Did they tell people why, like, save your clothes because, or just save
no,
your clothes?
No, save your clothes.
Okay.
You know? And basically, then there were other medium than newspapers or whatever that would tell them why they were doing this. But the posters really didn't explain anything. They just told you what to do.
Did people respond favorably to this? I would respond really negatively to just a random poster being like, do this.
Well, it generally worked. I mean, there were protests against some of these measures, and it wasn't everybody that followed them. And just as you know today, just because there's a rule doesn't necessarily mean people are going to follow it. But then when they looked at it then as a common good, then it did have more of a use, and it did people did follow them.
How did they convince people? I mean, I guess this is the British government when I say they.
Yes.
In around 1914.
Yes.
How did they convince people that it was for the common good if the poster, all it says is do this, do that?
Well, that was kind of how the society operated at the time. And it was, you know, you had a royal leader. You had a monarch who basically told the people what to do. And if this was seen as coming from the monarch and the prime minister and the elected government that they had, then there was very little question of that.
So speaking of what things were like, I mean, remind us what was going on in Europe as the nation states there started on this collision course toward war. I mean, bring us back to the spirit of that time.
Well, of course, trying to say what caused World War I is a lot longer program than you have today. But what really was occurring at the time was a rise in arms race, especially between Great Britain and Germany with the naval arms races. There was a great tug of war going on with colonial properties and gathering as large a colonial empire as these countries could have. And then there was also this undercurrent that was occurring at the time, and this is something that's still controversial among many of the scholars, there was a rise of nationalism, that there were people who were in these colonial areas or in these countries who really didn't follow the party line. They really thought they weren't being treated fairly. They were different language speakers. They were different religions. They were, did not want to necessarily go to war for the emperor or whoever was asking them or telling them to go. And so all these factors were contributing to this.
So is nationalism between European powers, and then also sort of a tension between the nationalism of those powers and the identity of people in colonies.
That's correct. And then also the powers, that was, a lot of them were related. I mean, of course, the Kaiser Wilhelm II and the British King and the Tsar were all direct descendants of Queen Victoria. And so there was sort of that kind of rivalry as well. But you did have this undercurrent that was there.
Where was the nationalism coming from? And I mean, this is a word that we throw around, but could you give a sort of quick user-friendly definition too?
Well, there was a forced nationalism. So like there was the German idea, you come to serve your country and, you know, your country will take care of you. Then there was the nationalism of people who were of different cultural backgrounds, different language backgrounds, different religions that wanted to observe those as well and not be subjugated to the will of an emperor or a king.
And then say, but so if nationalism is kind of brewing in Germany and it's brewing in colonies, is it also brewing in France and in England and in the United States?
Not as much. We're really more talking about like the Balkans with the Slavic nations. And of course, this is where the tensions really boil over, is in the Austro-Hungarian Empire's attempts to take over Serbia and Bosnia and the areas there. And so not so much in England or France, because these were more democratic societies, not necessarily completely democratic because you still had a king in England, but in the others you had a single supreme ruler who was basically telling people what they should do.
So if we're looking at, I mean, your exhibit focuses on posters in 1917. Just 100-year difference.
I say it the other way around. I say, well, we're in 1917, and I really mean 2017. So,
but we're going to get to 2017 and the significance of that year. But I'm curious about whether posters had anything to do with that nationalist fervor that you're talking about in 1914.
They did, in that they were, in many instances, were attempts to channel that nationalism.
So it existed already. It didn't create it.
No. And it also was to make, in some instances, ask you to support it, support your nation, support, you know, the beliefs that were already in existence. They weren't really creating a new theme. The themes were already there, and the posters were simply reflecting that.
So then in 1917, what happened? Why is that year significant enough to merit an entire exhibition?
Well, ever since before 2014, we started observing the centennial at the museum. And so every year, then our major exhibitions deal with that specific year. And of course, then in 1917, there are several things happening. One is America finally enters the war in April of 1917 as an active participant. America had been involved before that as a arms supplier and other materials to the Allied nations. And then you also have the incredible turmoil in Russia that started in 1917, almost at the same time. And so you're having these different things that are happening, and it really is this kind of a bellwether change. And then you have the countries who are already on the Western Front and on the Eastern Front, and so there is the stalemate. There is, you know, this has been the 3 long years of just slogging it out.
We're at the famous long winter.
Yes, and so, you know, this is a sea change that's occurring. And the posters are part of our exhibition for 1917, for the centennial. So the other special exhibition, which will open on April 7th, is really talking about these revolutions and the revolutions of both how a country goes to war and how a country completely changes itself. And so the posters are reflections of this. And so it's the real nice combination that we found in curating this exhibit.
Can you give me a clear-cut example of a poster that represents a country's need to change its position?
There are lots of them. And in our exhibition, there's really this, there's a recruiting poster, a U.S. Navy recruiting poster, and it shows the other allied nations' navies, the sailors, and how they're coming together, and how this creation of allies that had really not existed with the United States before, and it really still didn't exist because most people don't know. We talk about the allies who were fighting against the Central Powers, but the United States was never an ally. It was always an associated power.
What's the difference?
Well, the allies had a certain realm of rules that they were following, and the United States would come in with their own rules. And so they were associated with the allies, but they did not become an allied nation because they wanted to go their own way. And one of the ways that they did this was the formation of the American Expeditionary Forces that were under their own command and not under other nations' command.
So I'm thinking about there's a poster that just says, it's just words, "Have you a reason or only an excuse for not enlisting?" Whose poster is that?
I don't know. you threw me a curveball there. You know, because we have over 1,600 of them in the collection. So, I mean, even our archivist, when he came up when we were putting the exhibition up, he said, "Really? We have that poster in our collection?" So,
lots of them.
There's lots of them.
But clearly an English-speaking country, so that's either Britain or the U.S.?
Or Australia or South Africa
And that's such a consistent message that it could really be any of them?
Yes.
Wow. Talk to me about that.
Well, it was really, you had the same reasons for people to be in the war, and you had the same reasons for the need for support, and you also had the same reason for convincing people that they had their part in the war effort.
So along those same lines, there's this one that has the words, "America calls, enlist in the Navy," and that one has Lady Liberty looking... She's sort of taking the hand of a soldier, but you would think that this would be sort of a welcoming expression she might wear in this scenario, like, come on. But no, she looks really somber, and so does he. Like, they don't look happy.
No, and she's actually going for a sailor, not a soldier, because it's for the Navy. But
right.
It's more of the siren's call that's seen there, is that, you know, you come... And, you know, you'll see the world, but you're also going to have to help in winning the war.
But why, how is that somber tone persuasive? I mean, is this just a change in time period? Like, right now, I don't think that it'd be like, somber person,
oh, no,
okay, I'll join you.
It wouldn't work now. I mean, And plus, this is not an actual, this liberty is not an actual person. It's an embodiment of what the country means. And you can't have a smiling person saying, you know, come join the Navy. You know, you have to have, this is your duty. You are going to take the responsibility of helping your nation. And it didn't help that they portrayed her as a good-looking woman, you know, and so there was a certain appeal in that.
So just getting into maybe differences and similarities across countries, there are a couple of French ones. One that makes, I mean, more than a couple, but I mean, there's one example that I'll give that makes some sense to me. You have the words that translate roughly to like, just one last effort and we'll have them. And you've got Allied soldiers climbing a tall, craggy rock. And at the top, there's an eagle. It's a black eagle, and its feathers are coming off and floating in the wind. That one makes some sense to me. It's a 1917. We're 3 years into the war, and it's a message that, you know, we're almost there. Keep going, right?
Yes, and that also is an appeal to the Americans. You know, that we need you to come and get us to the top of the rock and to pluck the German eagle, which is what that's representing, and the Imperial eagle. And it was a way of encouraging this effort, encouraging people to, you know, one last push, we'll be there.
But then there's this other French one that I really don't understand. It's got a little girl playing with a toy soldier that's in bad shape, and he's bandaged up with like a sling and everything. And she's got a French poodle by her side with an empty food bowl in his mouth. And it's supposed to commemorate Bastille Day, the day the French people guillotined their king, Louis XIV. I do not get the connection between this poster and the war effort.
Well, it's on Bastille Day, but it's a fundraising effort for the wounded soldiers. And so her are the lost soldiers, and she's playing with the broken toy and the dog because her father is gone.
Oh.
And has not returned. And so this is an appeal to people, you can help this orphan.
You can help this little girl.
You can help this little girl. And also, as we find out whenever we do things on our social media, dogs get a lot of attention, dogs and cats. And so they knew that at the same time. This was part of their advertising ploy.
This is eternal?
Yes.
I'm curious about the look and feel of these posters. Did the technological limits of the time contribute to the power of these posters? Because it seems to me that simplicity is part of what makes an image work just at a glance. The more complicated they become, the less clear the image.
And I think that really had more to do with the artist than the technological advantages, because they could really do anything by this time.
Oh, okay.
In producing the posters. I think it had more with what the artist wanted to convey, what the government itself wanted to convey, and I don't think it really had to do with the technology.
When we hear about propaganda today, I mean, when we are inundated by headlines referencing things like quote-unquote fake news. I mean, given the work that you do as a historian and your focus right now on posters, I wonder if you hear and see current headlines in a particular way.
Well, I'll just preface that with saying not all posters are propaganda.
Can you tease out that distinction?
Propaganda is really creating an attitude and basically telling an untruth, to create a feeling of revenge, to create a feeling of, I've got to really get in this now.
So propaganda can't be based in truth? It can't be.
Oh, it can be, but it expands on that. And it creates a feeling that we think this is right, we think this is true, but, you know, just to give you an example, there's an American poster, which is not on exhibit because it's from 1918, but it shows Uncle Sam pushing against the Kaiser, who's cutting the hands off of little Belgian babies. Well, that never happened. But it was, you know, something that was used to get people's feelings to give, and it was really to raise money.
We have a question from a caller, and I know we didn't give the phone number, but this caller has an interesting question. So we're going to get him in here real quick. Is that cool with you?
Sure.
Okay, let's talk to Joe. Joe is calling from Kansas City. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. There are a number of posters and flyers that the German propaganda machine put out advising African Americans why they should not fight in the war because they were being lynched at home. And I think the museum has those flyers in their collection, but I have not heard anyone talking about them. And I think they would really add to the exhibit and probably draw more African Americans to come to the museum.
And basically what you're talking about are leaflets that were dropped over the lines in 1918. And where we will have these things when we get to that period in the centennial that we're dealing with. They were not available in 1917. They just weren't being used. So, it really sounds very arbitrary, but in this case...
But we're going year by year.
We're going year by year. And so in this case, there weren't these materials that were being used. And so...
But this is
interesting.
Will.
1918 is coming next year.
So it sounds like the transformation of posters from being tools of advertising to tools of sort of manipulating mass opinion. It seems like that started with official governments using that tool that way. And then that you see maybe kind of a fracturing where messages that go against the official government line, the party line, start popping up using this same exact technology.
That's correct. They just didn't have the backing of the government, and we're talking primarily here about the American government, to produce them in the scale. Just give you an example. In the Second Liberty Loan in 1917, there were 7 million posters produced by the government to be plastered up all over the country. And so the other side just didn't have that kind of support.
So the idea of the World War I Museum is to remember the war in order to protect peace, right?
Well, the National World War I Museum and Memorial is really there to teach the history of World War I through the material culture and then how its lasting effects to today of the World War. And since we're a global history museum, we deal with all the countries that were involved in the war. So we really don't take sides. We don't, you know, say there was a winner or a loser, but that all these nations were involved in this cataclysm that we call World War I.
What do you think that we learn in particular from this exhibit as far as, I don't know, what leads to conflict with regard to public opinion and what leads to peace?
Well, I think my main ideas in putting it together, one was the artistic value of these posters and looking at them from a purely artistic viewpoint. The other is how they were utilized by the nations in 1917 particularly.
Well, Doran Cart with me from the World War I Museum. Stick around through this break, okay?
Okay.
We have time for a break, but we're going to return to this conversation in a minute, looking at text and image, not in the past, but online today. That's next. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been talking about posters, how the combination of text and image contributed to war efforts both here and abroad 100 years ago in World War I. And we're curious about whether there are parallels in how we combine text and image online in memes. We are going to establish what those are in just a second. Our guests are Dan Mahala, who teaches rhetoric and new media at UMKC, and Cody Newell, KCUR's savvy social media editor. Hi, Dan.
Hello, Gina.
And hi, Cody.
Hello.
So for people who don't know what a meme is, Dan, I'm going to let you take a first stab at defining and explaining that.
Yeah. Well, I think it might be instructive to look back at the history of the emergence of that usage, the word meme. It actually comes from Richard Dawkins' book in 1976 entitled The Selfish Gene, in which he talks about memes spreading through the scientific community, an idea or catches on, and then the analogy is to gene. So meme is an extension of the word gene.
So wait, what is it that genes do, like as in genetics, that that someone might want to replicate in spreading an idea?
Well, yeah, genes replicate, right? They're in the theory of evolution, they spread. And so there's an analogy.
They spread themselves.
They spread themselves, yes, and through a biological and a statistical process. For Dawkins, he wanted to extend that biological process as a metaphor for culture. So cultural transmission is based on an analogy with biological transmission of genes. And the thing, and I mean, you get extensions of this usage when you see hear people talking about things going viral. There's a kind of implication that there's almost an automatic physical process that goes on behind our backs, if you will, and that memes are sort of based on that idea in Dawkins' thinking. Of course, since then, it's been decoupled from that as a source, and it's taking on a life of its own. And now we see memes, and they're, you know, they're very particular things we associate them with, dogs and cats, you know, with we see, you know, images with text laid on them. And it's even become enough of an automated process that if you look up meme-generating software, iMeme, RageMaker, you know, there are actual software packages that enable quick use of quick creation of memes.
So, Cody, if you were to describe what a person who sees a meme online sees, what is it?
I mean, it could be a couple of different forms, but I think the most common thing that people probably see is a picture of something. It could be, you know, if we're thinking politics, it could be a politician.
Or Gene Wilder.
Or Gene Wilder, or, you know, the condescending Willy Wonka meme that goes around all the time. But you'll have an image of something and then text overlaid, and that text is just modified as people kind of grab onto the meme and as it kind of replicates and goes throughout the internet. So that's, like, the most common form of a meme. You can also get into kind of deeper levels of, I would say, like meme culture, where there's meme videos and there's meme GIFs and there's a lot of different layers to it, to where it gets to the point where
those are just sort of quick, like
animated images, yeah. Basically, you know, like a 4-second loop of something that
someone moving and repeating a word or an eye roll, perhaps.
Right. Yeah. Something of that to that effect. But I think the thing is, I think memes have gotten to the point where a lot of people have trouble distinguishing whether or not they are an actual meme or not, or whether or not their content is actually true. And that's been definitely the case with the political kind of atmosphere we've been in for about the last year and a half, is that things have gotten really charged in terms of rhetoric and very loose with facts.
And so it started with just a simple image and phrase, and now you're saying that they can contain information which may or may not be true.
I mean, I would say in most cases, memes contain information that is or is not true. And the real distinguishing thing is that there are some memes that I would say have almost a malicious intent, where they are trying to spread disinformation or misinformation. Excuse me. And there's also some that the point is to be a little bit irreverent and a little ridiculous and not really, you know, just trying to poke fun at something, really.
I have a favorite meme, and it comes from the movie The Big Lebowski. I wanted to call it The Dude, but I realized that that's not the name of the movie. That's the name of a character. But there are these three characters who are often together in a bowling alley in that movie. And there's an image that just takes a line from the movie. It has these three guys in the bowling alley, and it says, "Well, that's just like your opinion, man." And I love that because it's kind of the anti-meme meme.
Right. And that is one of the most popular reaction memes or was for a while, where somebody would, you know, post something on like Reddit or something that had a political opinion or something to that effect. And somebody would just post that meme in response, just, "Well, that's just your like opinion, man." And it like just completely derails a lot of people because they're trying to be very serious about their political opinion or just any opinion they have. And then someone just comes in and drops that on them. And it really is an effective way to, I mean, it gets to internet culture and trolling really well, right? I mean, it's an easy way to troll someone.
So, Dan, you teach rhetoric. How would you describe, kind of, in terms of argument building, what is going on with memes right now? And why we're making our arguments this way?
Well, you know, I think I don't know if I'd call memes arguments because they're quick kinds of cultural shorthand. You know, you were talking about the German spiked helmet in the poster who spreads blood all over the world. And there's a way that you very quickly identify that's German even without a text.
What's an analogy in a meme?
Well, in a meme, you'll see Hillary Clinton and, you know, her face twisted up and then, you know, something that talks about her criminality or illegality. And in that
sense, there was also a lot of Bernie Sanders hair as a meme.
Yeah. And you know, what you're seeing there are kinds of like iconic images. Sometimes they're freely Photoshopped. I just saw an image of Hillbilly in which Hillary and Bill Clinton are one half the face is Hillary, one half is Bill. And, you know, the thing is that these images are being used iconically, right? They're sort of like a cultural shorthand for a particular person. And if it's an embarrassing pose, then it opens up to give a caption, a humorous caption, right? But, you know, I do think that it's important if we're going to talk in the context of these posters that we were talking about earlier, to say that there's a completely different political economy of memes and how they circulate. You know, for these posters, yes, they were cheap or cheaper than in the past, but basically memes are produced at zero cost. They can be distributed through social networks for free. You know, they can be produced by amateurs, right? You don't need any special technical. So it really is what I would call rhetoric as spreadability.
Is there a way to trace where a meme comes from? I mean, I see them shared a lot, and I often think, why are people sharing these, not knowing where they come from? Not, you know, I mean,
sure,
sometimes they're very funny, but you have that moment, I mean, at least I do, where I'm like, why does everyone share? I've seen this shared like 1,000 times. Where is it coming from? Who did this?
And that's a really important point about memes. I think that a lot of this culture of spreadability, participatory culture that I'm talking about, very low entry, you can get there very cheaply, anybody can make them. But the key thing is that it kind of blurs the boundary between the producer and the consumer. In the sense that if you send me a meme and I slightly tweak it and then I send it on, or I just send it on, who is exactly producing that? A lot of these are sort of produced by repurposing other people's materials. So it really does blur that boundary.
Have you been influenced by a political meme? Do you like to share them? If so, what's so compelling about them for you? Or if you hate memes, we want to hear why. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard, where we're talking about memes as possibly sort of an analogy to what happened with posters a century ago. Memes are sort of catalysts of public opinion right now in 2017, albeit in a very different political world and political economy. Our guests are Dan Mahala, a rhetoric professor at UMKC, and Cody Newell, who does social media for KCUR. We're also joined by Doran Cart, who is our historian, talking about posters in World War I. And you can call us to tell us about your relationship with memes, why you spread them, whether you've possibly made a meme, at 816-235-2888. But do it quickly. We've got a little under 10 minutes, so you don't want to put that off. Cody Newell, can you give us an example of some meme that has really gained currency that you think has followed an interesting path?
Well, I keeping in the theme of political memes and talking about politics, definitely the kind of star of the 2016 election cycle was this guy named Vic Berger, who started doing these videos. He would take footage of, say, like the Republican debates, and he would cut it in a way that would really emphasize just one theme of his videos is body horror, I would say. Just when somebody makes a weird face, or if they have a feature, he'll use software to emphasize that. So, like, for example, Donald Trump in the Republican debates, he made his face is rather orange. He has a rather orange hue. And so Vic Berger made the orangeness like 1,000 times more intense, and like lowered his voice and cut together his words to where he was just saying completely different sentences, but weren't that far out of the realm of something that you might think Donald Trump would say. So like he kept saying in one of the videos that I'm thinking about, he keeps saying Jeb is a mess. Just keeps saying that, and it's cutting to a picture of Jeb, and there's like air horns going off, and it's crazy, it's insane. But those videos in particular, and this guy Vic Berger, really blew up in a big way that I wasn't expecting. And I had seen his videos for a while, maybe like a year before that point, but he really got to the point where he was like, I mean, he is the guy when it comes to political meme videos. Like, nobody else is better than him, in my opinion, anyways.
So, but he takes things that Donald Trump didn't say, but they sound like things he might say?
No, it cuts together his actual words,
gotcha.
but rearranges them in a way that, you know, maybe says something that he didn't directly say, but, you know, it's not that far out of the realm of possibility of him saying.
So it's an interpretation.
Basically, yeah, yeah.
It's interesting because it sounds almost like using photographic and video techniques to create caricature.
Yeah, basically. And actually, this Vic Berger guy also does a lot of just straight up images. And one of the ones that's been going around lately that actually has kind of taken on I've seen some people spread it around not knowing it was a joke. He photoshopped a picture of Steve Bannon, the White House, I think he's an advisor, senior advisor. He photoshopped his face to look like very diseased and kind of puffy and gross, emphasizing again that kind of body horror. And I've seen some people spreading that around saying, like, oh my God, this guy doesn't look good. How is he in the White House right now? And it started as a complete joke, but some people have definitely been taking it and thinking like, oh God, this guy maybe doesn't need to be in the White House because he's maybe sickly.
So, Dan, rhetorically, what's going on here?
Well, listening to Cody and the body horror, what it sounds to me is maybe the historical analogy is the political cartoon, which is drawn and sort of identifies people by character. But it's within one thing that's different about it is that political cartoons used to be circulated in newspapers. Now we're talking about social media, where people are spreading it through social networks, friend networks.
Rather than there's an editor who has commissioned this cartoonist,
exactly.
And who has vetted the process.
Exactly. And so the bar to entry is lower, right? Because it's easier to produce a meme than to draw a political cartoon. But also it's being spread, and largely it's spread through, if you spread through Facebook friends or other social networks, it's tends to be spread among similarly minded people.
Who also what Cody was also getting at is that people may not know whether what they're looking at has been altered or is real.
Yeah, I mean, that's true, but I would say that's true for photography generally. If we compared memes, let's say, to war photographs of Syrian refugees, right? Those have spread virally on the internet. But the difference is that people are not going to make humor of them. The caption is the key thing on how to direct outrage over that image. A lot of times memes are not trading on the authority of the photograph in the way that war photographs are. War photographs are based on this idea that this really happened. Someone saw this. Whereas memes, maybe not. If Bannon can be just remade.
Yeah, let's talk to our callers about this. We've got Amy calling from Overland Park. Hi, Amy.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How about you? What can you share with us?
Well, I love memes if they're not degrading or showing somebody in a particularly negative or hateful light. I have made some memes. I've shared memes, but mostly ones that will make you laugh.
Well, can you give us an example of a meme you have made?
Oh, goodness. It's been a long time ago, but I took a picture of two wild turkeys walking in downtown Sioux City, Iowa. And during an election, I said, this is two politicians running for office, you know, something to that effect, because they were running down the middle of Main, you know, one of the main streets in the city.
Oh,
and, you know, so things like that, that will just, you know, be amusing, not necessarily picking on one side of the political, you know, spectrum or the other.
So what is it that you like about them? I mean, what do you enjoy about trading these kinds of images combined with text?
Well, I've often been defined as the queen of sarcasm. So to me, if it's, you know, if it's something that catches me and it's witty and it makes me laugh, then I like to share it. And sometimes I like to share memes that maybe I get and some other people might look at it and go, huh? But I just, you know, I just like that it...
you like, you know, getting the joke, kind of.
I do. I love that. And I prefer on my social media, you know, even though I'm slanted one direction in particular politically and et cetera, I like to keep my social media positive because I have friends whose children read my social media and enjoy it. And so I don't want to ever spin a negative light on the world.
Well, thanks, Amy. That's an interesting perspective. Let's talk quickly with Nolan from Lenexa. Nolan, what can you share with us?
Hi, Gina. Good morning. I was just calling about one particular meme that I think of all the time, and that's Pepe the Frog.
Describe
it. I don't know. He's a green frog, his cartoon, super red lips, always kind of looks high or tired.
One of those.
One of the two. But I kind of, that meme always sticks with me because of how it got co-opted by the alt-right. And now I see that they've made one for the far-right candidate in France. Pepe Le Pen is what they call it now.
Man, okay. Cody, are you able to describe, are you familiar with what he's describing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you cannot be on the internet right now looking at political memes without seeing Pepe the Frog.
How is this frog, as our caller puts it, co-opted by the alt-right?
Well, so he started out as this artist, I think his name was Matt Fury, drew him as just this kind of, it was part of this cartoon series, and it was just, you know, kind of this frog that, yeah, like the caller said, was always looking like he was stoned, and it was just kind of a chill frog or whatever. And then it kind of just somehow got used by the alt-right and used by far-right, I guess, adherents, as this, you know, they would Photoshop on like Donald Trump's hair onto Pepe, and do all sorts of weird stuff. And it went far worse than that too. I should say there's a lot of Pepes with swastikas and things of that nature out there. And it just kind of became this symbol of this really hardcore, I don't even know if irreverence is the word. It's just this really, I would say, almost disrespectful kind of just kind of mean-spirited sort of strain of memes that you just see out there.
Strange. Yeah, and just to piggyback on that, it sort of is dramatizes permission to be maximally politically incorrect.
Right, right.
You know, you go as far as you can. Speech that's way over the edge of sort of decent and civil is sort of authorized by Pepe the Frog, who's willing to transgress that line.
Weird.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to continue this conversation down the road. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're at the end of our show today. Cody Newell of KCUR, thank you.
Thanks.
And Dan Mahala, thanks for stopping by from UMKC's English
thank
department.
You.
Doran Cart, with us from the National World War I Museum at Liberty Memorial, thank you for taking us back to the past where some of these sort of rhetorical tools were used very, very differently.
That's right. Thank you, Gina.
The exhibit on posters as munitions in World War I is up through next year, so plenty of time to check that out. You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. And if you missed yesterday's conversation about South Asian students' reactions to the shooting in Olathe, you can catch up on that too. kcur.org/centralstandard. The show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tedhope, and Suzanne Hogan.